And with that, please join me in welcoming Marilyn.
There we go. It'll just push?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Hi, I am Marilyn, and I'm an alcoholic. Really happy to be in the midst of all these wonderful people. This has got to be one of the sweetest retreats I've ever been to. And I loved all that I said. If you heard... just wanted to see if you were listening. No, seriously, folks. If you heard Charlie this morning, you'll know what I mean when I say that I am at the whack-a-mole stage in my sobriety. And if you don't know what that means, you should have been here this morning. You would know. But I am... it was funny. He got to step 6 and 7, and there was a lot of repeats there. And that's what I find, especially in talking with the people that I sponsor. Steps 6 and 7 keep coming up again and again and again. And why is that so? Well, it's because people that I sponsor are often in horrible pain. And they don't have any idea why they feel so bad. And they, like I was in my first many, many years, found it very hard to accept what our literature keeps drilling into our heads, that when we are troubled, when we suffer psychic pain, we have to accept that there's something wrong with us. What a concept. It also goes on to say that our troubles are of our own making. And that both of those came as a great surprise to me. And they are very difficult for the people that I sponsor, especially the ones who are fairly new, to accept. If only that boss were not so demanding, if only she weren't so crazy, then I would be a happy person at work kind of thing. And that might well be true. The problem is, we don't pull the strings. We can't control these other people. And our program promises us, not just offers a possibility. I mean, it really does promise that we can be happy no matter what's going on around us. And that seemed very hard for me to believe, that the world stayed just the way it was and I could be a happy person. How could that be? And that's one of the main things that our program promises us and deals with it. And that is, how can we be brought around to that place where we can accept reality, accept whatever's going on, and enjoy it, have a good time, no matter what's coming down the road. Step 6 and 7, I think, offers a lot of help in that area. Charlie talked a lot about the inventory, and that's grist for the 6th and 7th mill. It's also grist for 8 and 9, of course. But a lot of the inventory is that uncovering of selfish pastimes, those selfish things. And when I wrote my first inventory, I was told to be rigorously honest, and so I was very careful and uncovered a lot of defects of character of my mother-in-law. Found that she was terribly lacking in many graces, and that was such a justifiable resentment, I thought. And therefore worthy of my attention to focus a lot of negative energy on her, to punish her. My sponsor began to talk about something called Marilyn's part in this sick and terrible relationship. Now, I had never considered anything like that, and that came as a great surprise. But in this simple first inventory, which focused entirely on the object of so much of my pain when I came into the program, namely my mother-in-law, that was the stuff of four more steps, not even counting the fifth step, which I was reading to my sponsor. As I read it to her, she began to point out, let's look at your part and how you could change so that you would not react so strongly to this and that and so forth. Now let's look at how you harmed her. As I said, that became the substance of the next four steps. It's a funny thing that I began to look at those things, and I said, okay, where do we go from here? Well, the amends step was make a list and all of that of these ways I had harmed her. I had to write two other inventories to find other people I'd harmed, many people, and put them on the list. But this stuff of six and seven, the character defects, that was a strange thing because I said, okay, now what do we do? And all the sponsors I've had, in fact, have been great appreciators of the big book. Now, the 12 and 12, of course, addresses all of those, but the main Bible that my sponsors have focused me toward has been the big book. So, of course, I got down the big book to study all the ways of going about steps six and seven, and lo and behold, there are two short paragraphs on six and seven. And I was horrified, and I said, but this is so much of what's causing me pain. You say it's my character defects, but the big book hardly tells us anything. And I had to consult with several old-timers before I began to understand what they were saying, and they were saying something in various kinds of words, but what it amounted to was, there's not much written about six and seven because that's where God does all the work. You have to become willing. And for someone who wasn't too sure about God at that time, that didn't offer much hope to me. I appreciate that ever more. Those are two steps now, six and seven, where I begin to see probably as much as any other part of my program, the finesse of God, the power of God. Holly and I were talking. She mentioned subtlety, and I thought, yes, that's a good word for this relationship with God. It's very subtle, and sometimes we miss it. Sometimes I miss it. But I was asked to consider the seventh step prayer. And that was a mysterious prayer, my Creator. And like Charlie, I have never been able to memorize anything in the big book, so this is my own way of saying the seventh step prayer, which I'm sure will not follow the words exactly. But I believe that I finally get the meaning of it. My Creator, I am now willing that you have all of me. And what am I offering to my Creator? The good. That would be nice. I want to give God something good and the bad. So I'm giving it all over to God, the good and the bad. And then I say, I pray that you now take from me every single defect of character. And does it stop there? No, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. So it says, that stands in the way of my usefulness to you, to God, and to my fellows. Doesn't say, make me a perfect person. It just says, get rid of that stuff that gets in the way of my being of service, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the last part is, grant me strength as I go out from here. For what? To develop my seven-year plan? To carry out my agenda? No. To do your will, your meaning God, to do God's will. And that has many, many ideas in it. And I think that part, I offer myself to you, God, the good and bad. And I thought, okay, I sort of get that. Now I know what's good and I know what's bad, and I have to turn it all over to God. My understanding was so shallow, so imperfect, that I didn't know what was good and what was bad. For example, when I was in my early years, I thought that guilt was good. That was noble. It made me feel bad, and it was punishment for the terrible things I had done, as I talked a lot about last night. I felt so bad about the children, being a bad mom. I also squandered a whole bunch of money in a lab that had given me a lot of opportunity. And I had just drunk a lot of beer and broken glassware, blown up things, ruined other people's experiments, gone out and demonstrated on campus, tried to close down the university, spent a lot of money, and called that science. So I felt bad. And so the noble part of that was that I felt a lot of guilt about that. So I had to come to understand that that guilt was not good. That was bad. So I had to offer that to God as a part of the bad, not a part of the good. My sponsor, who was such a great interpreter of God's communication with me, and still is, pointed out that guilt is a selfish pastime. You're using up a lot of energy with that emotion, Marilyn, she said. And that energy could be well spent in many other things. That's just a form of self-obsession, a very destructive form of self-obsession. So I suggest we get on to other things. She said that to me often enough that I could no longer indulge my guilt with her and tell her that I am a bad person, I am guilty, and so forth. She would just get back onto that thing. There were many of these things. In fact, in the beginning, almost all of those things that I thought were virtues turned out to be a part of the bad that I was offering to God. I loved my sponsor. I suppose I even loved my husband in the way that I interpreted love, which was to attach to you like a tick on a dog and suck out your life. parasitism. And that was used by God because it led me to seek approval ever so desperately that I would do things that went against my grain. But nevertheless, that kind of love, I had finally to accept that that's probably an unhealthy thing. That's one of the bad. And so it went. I picture, as newcomers, we just come wheeling wheelbarrows into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just heaped up with stuff. And it's mostly character defects, I do believe. And we just kind of tip it up and just dump it out into the center aisle. People in Alcoholics Anonymous begin to pick through it and say, well, we can use this dependency, this hideous dependency. Get a sponsor. Be dependent on your sponsor. So many of these things that were bad have been used by just holding them up, and let's just look at this in a different way. Guilt. Let's just get into writing an inventory and begin to make amends, that kind of thing. So in offering up the good and the bad, it all gets used. I think sometimes our character defects are used more profitably than those things which are good, which are humility. That's kind of a thing that makes us feel good. But it's those things that cause us pain that Alcoholics Anonymous can kind of get its teeth into. And it does. And the bite hurts. It hurts. But that is the beginning to recovery, I think. I am now willing for you to redo me. That second part of the seventh step prayer. Take away every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness. So I said when I came in, it was almost all defects of character. And so I'm essentially saying to God, get rid of it. Get rid of the old self, the Marilyn that comes in. I am giving God permission to kill that old self, essentially. Take that away, because all of that was in the way of being useful. Every thought about self, every manifestation of self, I want mine, I want you to like me, all of that gets in the way of me being useful. We talked about fear this morning, too. I didn't really see fear as a character defect, particularly, but that was pointed out that it's a corrosive thread that runs through so much of what we do. And I realized that it paralyzed me, and there were so many things that I wouldn't do because I was afraid. I didn't want to get up to the podium and talk because I was afraid. And I said, no, I can't do that. An old-timer said, of course you can. And they suggested ways that I could. All they had to do really was let me know that they wouldn't approve of me. And wanting their approval more than anything else in the world at that point, I was willing to do the unthinkable. And it turned out that you could get up to the podium and say just about anything. As I said, I talked about my existential angst at my first AA talk, and they went, because that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Making any kind of effort at all seems to bring on... But that's good, because otherwise I think that if I had sensed disapproval, I probably would not have proceeded. But it was just any effort. Now, in talking with newcomers and looking at my own character defects, I look back on that time now, and I see that there were those things that I couldn't identify, like fear and guilt and whatnot, but my sponsor identified that and helped me with it. But when I was new, I was like a car, an alcoholic car. Headlight out, taillight out, dents, so forth, windshield wiper missing. And so I was taking it to the mechanic, and what I believe that we can handle on our own in steps 6 and 7 is just what an alcoholic car looks like. In other words, you can see a headlights out. That's fear. Okay. So I have to become willing to let that go once it's pointed out to me that that's a defect. It's been suggested to me, and what I use with the people that I sponsor is that not only do I have to ask God, please remove this defect of character because it's getting in the way of my being useful, but I have to also ask, please, to replace it with something. I believe that nature abhors a vacuum, as some ancient philosopher said. We can't replace something with nothing. So if we have fear, fear is taken away. But what's that? I think it's useful. It's useful to me to say, please, dear God, I have a lot of fear, and can you please replace it with faith in you and courage for this thing that's coming up? It's just a helpful exercise for me to replace those things that cause me so much trouble, self-obsession with interest in other people, envy. Please, dear God, replace it with celebration for what you have. That kind of thing. That's like seeing that the headlight's out and getting new headlight. You just don't take out the old headlight that's all broken and smashed. You have to put in the good headlight, the one that turns on and glows. That's good. And yet you can do all of that and the car eventually looks okay. I mean, that's what I could do. I could identify a lot of these things that the 12 and 12 talks about. It. The 12 and 12 goes into a lot of detail about manifestations of self and mentions the 7 deadly sins, pride, anger, lust, envy, greed, gluttony, and sloth. Yes, my favorite. I almost forgot it. And we can, I think it's kind of a useful spiritual exercise to just go down the list and find out all the ways we've indulged and enjoyed all of those deadly sins. Eventually they are deadly, of course, but they feel so good as you're going down. And And that's why I didn't notice that they were bad for so long. They seem like good. But as I said, I didn't know good from bad. And so we can do that. That fixes up the outside of the car. But as I drove my car into Alcoholics Anonymous, the great diagnostician, I think, God acts in this fellowship, began to do a job on me. It turned out that not only were headlights out, the windshield wiper missing, and so forth, the transmission was trashed. And the engine was broken down with all kinds of exploded gaskets, or however you talk about engines. And the brakes were shot. And that was the condition of it. In other words, that stuff deep, deep inside had congealed in such a distorted and wrong kind of way. And there were no words for any of that. I didn't know what was wrong with me. Not only did I not know what these superficial things, these things that really were glaring that I could feel on the surface, fear, envy, paranoia, anger, resentment, seething resentment, that one was burning my conscious mind, and I was aware of it, and people around me were aware of that. But this deep inside stuff that controlled my life, that made me drink year after year after year to get rid of some pain that didn't even have a name, that was the inside, that was the engine that I could not see. And other people couldn't see it either. So that presents a real dilemma. And that's why I think the seventh step prayer is written in the way it's written. I give it all over to you, to God. I am willing that you have all of me. That's the insight, the engine, the transmission, the whole part, the part that I don't even know about. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what drives me to self-destructive behavior, to the behavior that hurts other people, that cannot get out in the world and be a productive citizen. I don't know what that is. Doesn't have a name. Doesn't even have an emotion that I could describe to other people to get help with. So this just seems like we are in a pickle. We are in a real predicament. If we can't name what's wrong with us, how in the world are we going to repair it? Well, the good news is that we don't. God seems to know what's wrong with us. And that is the subtlety. I began to do those identification things and was willing for God to replace the negative with the positive, and then just started living and going along with the fellowship, not realizing that God was still effecting steps six and step seven. And I think that that's a lifetime process and beyond this lifetime. I don't believe that we ever rise above human, and I don't think that all of these deep and terrible things that get in the way of our usefulness ever disappear completely, no matter how long we live and how active we are in Alcoholics Anonymous. But again, the big book is so honest and so right. It says we are not saints. The point is we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. And as long as we seem to be doing that, we can be happy, and we can be happy with the progress. And other people can be happy because they know what we were like, and we're not quite like that anymore. So they see the progress too, and that's good. But what is this kind of stuff that I'm alluding to? And that is one of the early things I talked about last night. And that was this terrible, terrible guilt I felt about children. I could identify guilt and be willing to have that go, but I didn't even understand the way that that was manifesting, that somehow, some way, I wanted my children to be better than anybody else's children, just to be equal to them, because I was coming from so far back. And I never could have put that in words. Somehow I was, through probably making amends, being shown the things that were right in front of me. I was finally able to see that, and that was after the healing had occurred. That's the subtlety of God, the finesse, just leading me through a series of things where it feels like not much progress is being made. And then I realize, my gosh, I'm using the past tense. That's what that was all about. That's happened so many times. I didn't know that I was fiercely dependent on these people that I had attached to in this sick and hideous way. They probably knew and were uncomfortable about it, but when early on my sponsor, my beloved sponsor Marion, told me she was moving away, she was going off to another city and that I'd have to find another sponsor, and I said, no, you can't do that. I just don't think I could stay sober if you go away. And she said, of course you can. I have to go. And I said, but don't go. At least let me keep you as a sponsor. And she said, no, Marilyn, you're far too intense to have a sponsor in another city. You must find another sponsor. And I said, well, let me go with you. And she said, no, Marilyn, you have amends to make at home. You have a husband and little children that remember a lot of unhealthy things. So let's stay and begin to make amends to them. And I just said, I'll never find another Marion. And I said it with big tears in my eyes. And I remember that she and Byron started driving to Upland, and I held onto the bumper of the car and bounced along the 10 and dropped off, I think, at El Monte, all bloody about the chest. And I don't think it really happened that way, but that's certainly the way it felt. And what was happening was that this dependency was wrested from me. This was broken, absolutely broken. It's true, I never found another Marion. That was the bad and sad news. The very, very good news was that now I didn't need another Marion. I needed a goddess of sobriety, something superhuman, something that I could not admit had any slight imperfection. And it's just good she moved away, because I never had to live to see that she was human. The strange thing is that Marion moved back. We're all in the same home group now, and she's a good friend of mine. And enough time passed so that I could let go of that need to put goddess of sobriety back on the pedestal. And she's much, much more wonderful as a human being. We don't really know goddesses because they don't exist, but I can know Marion as a human being. And that's even more wonderful to know her as a human being than some fantasy perfect creature. That dependency was broken. I couldn't have done it on my own. I often find out what I am holding on to only as it is taken away from me. I had that kind of dependency on my husband, and he wasn't taken away from me. But through a series of events, there were four significant people in my life. Marion was one of them. They were all sort of snatched away at the same time over a period of about a year. And two of them died and two of them moved away. And I was precipitated into an abyss. I just called it an abyss. A priest once told me, I was taking a course at UCLA being given by a guy, Father Elwood Kaiser, that called himself the Hollywood Priest. And who knows how all of this is orchestrated, but he was a perfect person at that time. And I told him about this thing that I was going through. I didn't think I was going to survive it. And he just looked serious and he said, dark night of the soul. And I thought, good, that has a nice ring to it. That sort of gets at what it was, but what it amounted to was just deep and hideous psychic pain, a great upwelling of emotion. And I didn't know what was going wrong with me. A couple of old-timers thought I was going insane. Luckily, that was at a time, that was back in the early 70s, when you didn't immediately take somebody off to the hospital and super medicate them. I just was there to do it on the natch. And I am grateful for that, because what seemed to happen was that this was one of those parts deep inside, an engine that was broken. When I was a kid, when I was 10 or 11 years old, my father was in a grinding auto crash and went off to the hospital. And he had suffered severe brain damage. And the neurologist said, we don't hold out much hope for him. But I had hope because as I walked into the hospital room, he began to cry. Every time I visited, big tears would come down his cheeks. And I thought, he's there. He sees us and he's sad and he wants to be well. And the doctor said, that's a reflex. It's disturbing, but nevertheless, there's very little, if any, conscious thought there. That's just a reflex. We don't hold out much hope for him. And I think I tried everything. I think I even, because it was Ohio, that was the Bible Belt, even attempted to pray to this God that people in Ohio prayed to. And of course, I didn't expect an answer, and there was none. The answer was he just lay in that hospital bed day after day, year after year, for 12 years, and then slipped away, and then he was gone from this earth. And I never experienced any emotion about that. Wasn't sad about it. I thought it was strange. But there was nothing that ever could be called grief about that. A good friend of mine, Diana, still a friend of mine, I got sober about the same time. She said, you know, you should really look at that. Did you write about that in an inventory? And I said, no, you know, it just didn't bother me, to tell the truth. And she said, but, I mean, that's a big deal. That had to bother you. Well, it was a big deal. That, I think, was one of those things that had just grown up wrong. And it turns out in Alcoholics Anonymous, even those things that get set in concrete, terrible abuse, for example, as a child, there's hope here. No matter what it is, I believe that the subtlety of this program, God acting through this program, can get at these things that nothing else can. That's, I think, what began to get sorted out. That was this upwelling of deep and hideous pain. I grieved. I grieved over getting screwed out of a father. Damn it, I should have had a father like other people had. And I missed him terribly, and that was sad. And it took until I was in my late 30s before I could just face up to that. Yeah, I really feel bad about that. That really made me sad. I just never experienced that emotion, but just pretended that he was still there by attaching to everybody that would allow me to attach. My husband, please be a caretaker. Just allow me to sink my teeth into you and demand everything, have a sense of entitlement, and ask nothing in return from me. Be a good, good daddy, like a three-year-old deserves. And I just went through life. No wonder people were absolutely appalled by my conduct. But I couldn't see it because I was in many parts that three-year-old that just needed to be taken care of. I got screwed out of that, so I'm going to find it somewhere. Every professor became that person. My sponsor, Marion, was that person. And she was pulled away as these other important figures. One was an important professor in my life, and one was a man on the program that had been kind of a guru for me. They were just all taken away at once. And it just finally allowed me to experience that appropriate emotion after all those years. So I'm a great believer in losing somebody. Cry about it. Cry because your heart is breaking. That's a way of saying, I love you. I miss you. I'm going to cry about you. And then I'll celebrate your life in the tears. And it is so healing. The good news, I think, in Alcoholics Anonymous is that's very much wrapped up in the sixth and seventh steps. These things that were never permitted to us for whatever reason. Too scary, not allowed, we had to be brave, whatever. We finally have the chance to regrow, go back, find that place where it took a wrong turn, and then grow up right. Because we play these parts for one another. We're mothers, fathers, children, sisters, brothers, so that we can undo a lot of that. So I didn't even know what was wrong. There's no way that I could have gotten at that. I don't think that the best psychiatrist. Dr. Jung probably could not have led me through that. But that was permitted in Alcoholics Anonymous. We seem to be given a sheltering environment that sets up circumstances so that we are healed of these things that are so deep that we don't even know are harming us. And I have just appreciated that so much in these later years, seeing it happen in my life in several different ways, seeing it happen in the lives of the people I sponsor. And why is that important? Because it stands in the way of our usefulness to others. We ask God then for strength as we go out from here. That means just to go out from that process of being healed, I believe, to do God's will. And you say, well, that doesn't sound like a very good reward. I mean, here we get fixed up and we get the engine fixed and we're a nice shiny car. We ought to be able to drive it anywhere we want. And I think that as alcoholics, we would just drive it right off the cliff. So we have that third part of the prayer, which is, grant me strength as I go out from here. Strength meaning power, and power up my engine, fill it up with gasoline as I go out from here to do your will. It's a funny thing that that just sounds like we're asking to end up in total bondage to something that's even hard to identify, this thing we come to call God, higher power. Give ourselves over completely to Alcoholics Anonymous. Always say yes. Would that be fun? Well, it doesn't sound fun to a newcomer. It certainly didn't sound like fun to me. I just kind of imagined that kind of life as being a long cave, and it's gray, and you enter the cave, and somebody puts a broom in your hand, and you say, okay, now, what do I do? And they say, start sweeping and go that way. And there's no end to the cave. It just goes farther back. And you just start sweeping and sweeping. That's what that kind of promise sounded like to me. I guess as years go by, I'm convinced now that the greatest freedom we can ever possibly have is being in total bondage to God or Alcoholics Anonymous. Charlie has said now and then, and I'm going to misquote you, of course, but what I gather from what I think I heard him say is that a measure of my spiritual condition is how willing I am to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Is that close? Okay. He raised his eyebrows. And it turned out that in those times when I have been most willing, saying, yes, okay, I will go to Fresno. I'll go to Bakersfield. I'll go to Flagstaff, Arizona. Whatever Alcoholics Anonymous wants me to do, I will do it. That's when I am the happiest. That's when I have the most, what seems like, free time, being in total bondage to God through Alcoholics Anonymous is the only freedom I've ever known. Why are opposites always true in Alcoholics Anonymous? Surrender to win. Being in total bondage to God is perfect freedom. I don't know why all of that's true. I do know that's why I didn't get it for so long, because my brain was always trying to figure out the universe in some kind of logical way. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't make any sense in that respect to me. I can only recount what happened. And rather than confusion, I now see it as subtlety, as finesse. The phrase God's grace didn't mean anything to me for a long time, but I've begun to see it as that force, that quality, that is that great bridge between how far I can go to doing what I think is being asked of me and the final destination. And that is, I'm willing to give up these character defects that I can identify. And I do that, and I do it to the best of my ability. And then all of a sudden I am led through the great abyss to this place where I feel free. after that dark night of the soul, when the pain just kept getting ever more intense, why was that a good thing? Well, at that moment when I just felt like I can't go on, I just said to God, I want out. And at that point, the veil parted, and I thought, oh, that's what this is all about. And I experienced the presence of what I've come to call God as total love, total energy. I had a moment when I was desperate with pain, when there was that transparency, and I could, I won't say see it, but experience that for myself. That prayer so long ago, God, if you're really there, I'd like to get to know you, and I'm willing to go on any path you pick for me. What a thing. I could not have imagined what that was. A path through a lot of pain, and then the experience is perfect love, infinite love, healing in a way that I didn't even know there was a sickness. I've seen that happen in my relationship with the children. I didn't even know the kind of sickness that existed in the relationship. I could only go so far, make amends by trying to get Becky to play the cello. And here God was subtle and saying, let her play the guitar. It's okay. Heal up yourself. See things in a new way. See them as perfect children of God. But inside, healing had to occur. I've been led, and that, I believe, is grace. We do as much as we can do. We identify these things, and then we say to God, okay, now I'm standing at the cliff. And then God says, okay, jump off the cliff. And you say, that doesn't sound good to me. And why is that not good? Well, you can't see what's going to happen. That seems to be a part of it. Thank God for old timers because they say it's safe. Just jump in and do it. I guess that if I could wish you something really nice, I would say, may you end up in total bondage to God and Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Oh, I sit down now. With the question and answers, again, a reminder, it's an opportunity to ask a question, not to share. And with that, Marilyn?
Ah, yes, thank you, Jennifer. Hi, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. All right, the question that I think, of course, is what happens if we're not willing, as those two paragraphs on 6 and 7 say, become willing to have God remove all these defects of character. What if we're not willing? I don't think any of us are willing to let go of these things. I was so unwilling that I thought they were all good. I think that the best we can do is what we're advised to do on all of those things where there's an amount of unwillingness is to pray to our higher power for willingness, because that's what we're lacking. And I think that God answers that prayer through deep and hideous psychic pain. That's been my experience anyway, and at some point I beg for mercy, which is, okay, I'm willing now. I'm willing to let go of this one. But as I hope to say, we can't then just simply say, I'm willing to let it go, and then it's gone. That's the beginning of the work that God begins to do on us, which amounts to some kind of psychic surgery. And it is sometimes fast, sometimes slow, but I think it does begin to occur at that moment where we turn that key. That key is willingness. And as long as we're halfway cooperating with the program, I think we are brought into those circumstances that stimulate those character defects And when character defects are stimulated, what is the response? Pain. And that drives us to ask for willingness, finally to become willing. Yeah, painful. Yes, Aaron.
Hi,
Aaron. Hi, Aaron. The question was, in those times when I have experienced psychic pain, the pain of life, really, have I received help from outside of Alcoholics Anonymous? No, I got sober a long time ago when there was not quite the outreach that there is now. I know our big book says that we can seek the help from professionals, psychologists and psychiatrists, but I was in the Pacific group, and that's a group down in Southern California, with a lot of support. And I had some people that babysat with me during these periods when I underwent a lot of internal rearrangement and a lot of experiencing the pain of these defects, these things that had grown up wrong. Diana and Beverly in particular seemed to give me unconditional love. It was whatever you're going through, whatever's happening to you, just you can lie on my floor and you'll get through this. And this absence of judgment about that was very healing. And I was allowed to just, this process ran on its own accord. And for me, a lot of it was, as I said, this unresolved grief. But I've sponsored women who have had horribly abusive childhoods, and they have to be mothered, and they have to act out some of the anger and know that that's safe. And I think that if we are entirely willing for God to do whatever God needs to heal us, we can find that in the context of this fellowship, in a group that has a lot of structure, where there's a lot of support, where everybody's into everybody else's life. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with turning to good help on the outside, too. That just hasn't been my experience. But that is certainly a part of the AA tradition. I think it is sometimes important to do that, though. If we want to live life on the natch, I think we would all like to live on some kind of incredible high all the time and be perfectly efficient people and just spread love and joy everywhere. But in order to do that sometimes, we have to allow ourselves the experience of these things that seem to cause the human being great suffering. And that's life. We lose a good friend through death or moving away or whatever. Many people on the program have lost a child. A woman in our home group lost her beloved 18-year-old son right before his high school prom. We all surrounded her, and what did she do? She got ever more active in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's come through that, and she is respected and loved by all. She is so powerful in being able to help other people now that are entering into things like that. And that's life. That's as much of life as getting that good job. These days I say to women that I sponsor, this is not quite on that question, but I think it's relevant, and because I think it's so important. I find myself saying, because I've come to believe that we'll be happier people in the happy, joyous, and free sense if we stop using the words good and bad as applying to events in life. That's good. You got a raise. That's good. You got a bad diagnosis. Oh, that's terrible. That's bad. It prejudges it, because so often those things that have seemed so terrible to me, being taken into Alcoholics Anonymous is the first example. What a sentence. How shameful and terrible. That turned out to be the greatest blessing in my life. These One time I threw a series of bad mistakes on my part. I brought down a whole lab. That was after I'd been sober and went back to work in the same lab where I drank a lot of beer. I was making amends, and I made a bad mistake on a grant application, and the lab was not funded, and 21 people were out of a job. Now, you could say, that's bad. But I was told, don't even think about it in that way. That is. It's happening. And I said, well, I have to kill myself. I mean, just as a matter of honor, fall on a sword or something. And Ruth Kay, a wonderful person down in southern, well, she's moved up north now. But anyway, she said, she's the person I managed to get on the phone when we got the news from National Institutes of Health. Your multimillion dollar grant will not be funded. She said, it's far nobler not to fall on your sword. It's far nobler to go to an AA meeting tonight, tell everybody about it, and then certainly talk to the director and say, what can I do? Is there any way we can begin to undo this damage? And I thought, no, I can't do that. I have to kill myself. She shamed me into staying alive that day. And I did. I went to Ohio Street, our little meeting place, and I told one person. I got called on to participate as just as if by chance and told it from the podium. And I was astonished that nobody felt it was as bad as I thought it was. I look back on that time now, and I see the value of not saying, that's bad. That was. That's what happened. I made a mistake. I made an error. But I did what Alcoholics Anonymous advised me to do, which was to ask if there was any way to undo the damage. I certainly apologized for my part in that sorry thing. And the people that were in the lab all went on to better things, strangely enough. That was a lab that in its way was dying. The director wanted to leave the position. He wanted to go to France, but he felt some sense of loyalty. The workers were ready to retire. They didn't want to work there anymore. There were a few students, but they wanted to move to another lab because they felt that this lab is on the way out. I just dealt the death blow by my mistake. But that allowed lives to go on. The director did go to Strasbourg and became a director there and was happy, and I went back to school and learned a profession that I practice to this day that I enjoy much more than wet science in the lab, which I'm so bad at. My colleagues all fared a lot better. It just needed a catalyst to get people going. So that seemingly bad, hideous thing really turned out to be a blessing to just everybody involved. So I think it's, again, embracing reality, taking a judgment off of it. I often say to people I sponsor, and I say it to them so that I try to practice it myself, and that is the assignment is to regard everything that comes my way today as good. If I can't take all judgment off, then at least let me recognize it all as good. And just make a case for everything that happens as being good. You get 20 red lights on the way to work. That's good. How is that good? That's a nice spiritual exercise. Because in the end, like, I don't know what's wrong with me, as I dwelt on and raved on about. I don't know what's good and I don't know what's bad in terms of the world either. Yes. Amy Beth. Hi.
You've been in AA for quite a while now. Mm-hmm. Are there any interesting little character defects that have come up for you later in your sobriety? Mm-hmm. Like, kind of like the Jesus is a man thing? Something that you just didn't even see? And all of a sudden it was like, oh, bam!
Oh, man. The question is, have any strange and wonderful little defects come up in my later years? And, of course, they come up every day. And they're not strange new character defects. They're just the same old ones that show up in novel ways. And they're all so petty and horrible. And that's how I know I have to tell somebody about them. And I mean, one of them, I ended up taking care of my four little grandsons this past summer because our two daughters were busy doing important things. And so anyway, Grandma stepped in and they moved into Grandma's house. And there was one day when I just was trying to be a good grandma. And Peter, my oldest grandson, is 8 years old. He found two quarters in the front room. And he showed me and he said, "I found them, finders keepers." And I looked at him and I said, "Where did you find them?" And he said, "In the front bedroom." And he was getting a little bit nervous. And he said, "Finders keepers." And I said, "You found them, but you found them in my house." And I thought, what am I saying? I felt so guilty that I gave all four little grandsons $2 apiece. I mean, I just don't know how selfish I am until my grandson tries to keep two quarters he found on the floor in the front room. And it's just so embarrassing that I quickly had to call somebody and tell them about it. And of course, they laughed at me. As I just realize again and again, we never get beyond human, frail human. But the wonderful thing is that we can share it and it doesn't kill us. I mean, I am a sensitive soul and I could do terrible damage to myself and other people over things like that. Once I tell things like that, it diffuses and to the point of being absolutely ridiculous. But it always seems so serious when it is my own stuff. So, who was it? Somebody in L.A. whose name escapes me. But anyway, he used to say something like, when he dies, he's going to come face to face with God, and God will say, "Did you get the joke?" Riley. It was Riley. And if you say no, then God says, "You got to go back." And I just am beginning to think, if we can laugh at most of this stuff, we'll be better off. Yes, Chris.
Marilyn, with defects of character or fears that you, mm-hmm. once you've taken the seventh step, uh-huh. that continue to bubble to the surface, mm-hmm. Do you have any experience or do you have any practice with the acting as if type mm-hmm. philosophy? Mm-hmm. The 12 by 12 says, mm-hmm. God won't render us white as snow without our cooperation. Mm-hmm. That's uh-huh. And you hear people say, act as if the defect's being removed, mm-hmm. and because it is, and that's our cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question is, what part does acting as if play in connection with the sixth and seventh step in terms of having our character defects removed? I think that if we see acting as if in that way of taking that action because we know that's a good thing, that is approved by Alcoholics Anonymous, then we can take that action and our emotions begin to follow. That is certainly true. Everybody who has lived a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous says that in one way or the other. Chuck Chamberlain, I think, is the one that first impressed on me that he was saying that because he kept saying, you can't think your way into right acting, but you can act your way into right thinking. And I think that so much of this program is listening to a sponsor, and the sponsor says, do this, do that, and you end up doing it. And then you realize that you are feeling that way and thinking that way. That follows the action many times. Whether that works for six and seven, I think it does. Chris and I were talking about that earlier. I don't think of it in that way, but that's exactly what it is. If I say, God, I have a lot of fear, For example, I'm asked to go speak somewhere where there's a lot of old timers, and I think they're going to judge me harshly, and I just can't do it. I have to think of a reason. I have to say no, that paralysis by fear. And then if I talk to anybody on the program, they'll say, of course you have to go. That's an AA request. So then I have to say, God, please replace the fear I have with courage and faith in you, God, and faith in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I call the secretary and say, yes, of course I'll do that. That's acting as if, because I still feel like I can't do that. But what happens once I get the order from Alcoholics Anonymous, talking to my sponsor or some old-timer that I trust, and finding, yes, indeed, you have to do that. From that first talk on, where I was asked to give a 10-minute talk in my home group, and I said no to the secretary, and the secretary said, go talk to your sponsor about that. And then pretty soon I was stepping up to the podium after conferring with my sponsor. That one thing, once I know that that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is asking me to do, then I begin to walk into it. And the fear has entered a new spectrum. It is no longer that kind of fear that is all mine, that keeps me from doing anything or even talking to anybody. It is, okay, I'm at the cliff's edge and you've told me to jump off the cliff, and I don't know how this is going to feel, but I don't think it's going to be good. I've never enjoyed public humiliation. But okay, even that, I'll survive it. And then I just simply jump into the abyss. And I find that the ground is solid. And there's always a spiritual lesson. Of course, acting as if is a big part of that. I think it is also what I talked about, this concept that is it ever more appealing to me, which is just this idea of God's grace, that I get the word from Alcoholics Anonymous, go forward with something that I don't feel too secure about. In other words, replace fear with courage. And I will step as far as I can, and then I am extended some kind of grace. I am empowered to do that thing I'm asked to do. Time and time again, I was asked to teach a class in sobriety. It was the first time. It was at one of the local universities, I mean local to Southern California. And that first class I taught, my reaction when I was called, can you come and teach this class, was no, of course not. I couldn't do that. And I thought, well, you know, I better talk to a few people. And I first talked to my daughter just by chance, who is now actually teaching in a university. And she said, of course, Ma. They all call me Ma, as in Ma Kettle. That's exactly right for you. You're perfect for that. And I thought, what is she saying? So then I thought, she's wrong. She's not an alcoholic. And I talked to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, of course you can do that. You ought to use your education for something. You've just been a deadbeat all these years. Why don't you start paying back? So I knew I couldn't do that, but I thought, okay, I will take those steps in that direction. So I called the chairman, and I said, okay, I'll teach that course. What do you have in mind? And 14 weeks, you have to map out the topics and make a syllabus. Okay, I can't do that, but anyway, I sat down at the computer and I mapped it out. I talked with other people and I started getting into it. And I thought, well, okay, I can probably make a syllabus and I can probably show up and greet the students. And that worked. I got there and I got through the first class and it went okay. And they did their assignments. I graded their homework and we had this give and take. I was still pretty nervous about it. And then about week 12 or 13, I was driving home thinking, you know, this isn't so hard. This isn't so hard at all. And I had the feeling, I'm doing it all. It's piece of cake kind of thing. It was interesting. I went through this process with my daughter, and I was so happy that I had that experience when she just knew that she couldn't possibly teach a course. and she had to give a big survey course on immunology. And I said, Susie, of course you can teach that class. That's perfect for you. You were put on earth to do that kind of thing. I was saying to her just what my daughter had said to me, Lo, those 20 years ago. And it felt different when she was hearing it instead of saying it. But she did exactly what I did. She showed up and she met the class and got through it, and it was fine. I knew what she was going to say. And her thing was every day, 8 hours a day for 14 days in a row, or 2 weeks in a row. So at day 12, she said, you know, this isn't so bad. This isn't so bad at all. I think I can do this. And I said, and I think you're getting a little bit of help, too. She has grown up under the influence of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she understands about grace. She understands that there are just many things that she cannot do. But if she asks for help and steps up to the brink, then somehow that bridge of grace is extended over the abyss and gets to walk across, as we all do. But a lot of that does, you know, you could say, that's acting as if. We just take that step out there and then say, can I have the power to do it now? And surprisingly, it usually comes. Yes. Oh, it's Chris. Hi. Hi, Chris.
You talked about this, though, and something I've heard before is that God will only remove those defects of character which are down in the way of your usefulness to Him. Do you believe that? Do you believe that you still have some character defects that may not have taken away for any specific reason that may be useful otherwise?
That is such a deep metaphysical question. The question is, in our seventh step prayer, we ask that God take away those defects of character that stand between our being useful to God and to our fellows. And are those character defects taken away also that don't get in the way of being effective to others and to God? I think that we come around to the feeling, and I mean, I certainly do in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only defects worth talking about are the ones that stand in the way of being useful to God and to our fellows, because if we are practicing these principles, as Patrick so eloquently talked about this morning, if we practice these principles in all our affairs, then I think evermore life just becomes being of service. We get up in the morning and we say to God, help me be of service today. Give me my assignment. So almost everything we do, from brushing our teeth, we have to have our teeth right because that's kind to other people to look at clean teeth and have fresh breath and all that. That's being of service to others. And everything we do, in a way, is being of service to others. Anything that stands in the way of our functioning in the world then gets that grace, that help. But there are some things that I have wanted to do. I guess that I could think that maybe these are defects and that God's not helping me out. I was talking with Andrew, and we were talking about music because I love music. I love it. I love it. I love it. And there is just this quirk of nature that somebody like me could be put on earth with such a love of music and have absolutely no musical talent. And how can that be? Well, it is. And as I said before, we embrace it. That's not bad. That is. Okay. But I could see that I have sat down and practiced the guitar. I have sat for hours and tried to play guitar music. And it always sounds like the Moscow beginners. And God has not chosen to remove that lack of musical talent from me. I think that if most people somehow vanished from earth by bird flu or something, and there needed to be music, and I was the only person left with fingers, probably God would endow me with the gift of playing the guitar and amusing my fellows. But it would have to come to that for that to be seen as being of service, because there are so many people that can play the guitar that I am out of luck. So in that sense, yes, yes. But that's the last question. Here we go.